Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
You know how we say businesses hate uncertainty? We say it quite a lot. Actually, sometimes that uncertainty can be quite intentional. Also, when your day job is running one of the world's busiest airports. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 7th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The headline of President Trump's trip out to Ohio today was his bully pulpiting of his infrastructure plan. Event number two on the itinerary, though, was an appearance with what the White House calls victims of Obamacare. The president's trip comes as Anthem, the big health insurer, said it's pulling out of Ohio's Affordable Care Act exchanges as of next year, citing a lack of certainty. Competitors Aetna and Humana have already said they're leaving all their exchanges next year, same reason. So whence comes all that uncertainty? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer gets us going.
Health insurers need to know what the future will bring so they can price their health plans for the coming year. Under President Trump, the future of Obamacare is anything but certain.
The largest uncertainty is how much the Trump administration is going to be enforcing the individual mandate to purchase insurance.
That's Vivian Ho, a health economist at Rice University. She says without the mandate, young, healthy people could decide to skip insurance, leaving insurers with the sickest, most expensive patients. Another uncertainty, the fate of federal subsidies that make high-deductible plans on the Obamacare exchanges affordable. The upshot? A fatal blow to the Affordable Care Act, says Cynthia Cox at the Kaiser Family Foundation.
The Trump administration and Congress have the tools to dismantle these markets without necessarily even passing a new law.
Cox says in Iowa, there's only one insurer left on the Obamacare marketplace, and there's no insurer offering Obamacare policies for a large part of Missouri. That means people who would ordinarily buy policies on the exchanges and get subsidies would be forced to buy on the individual market without subsidies. Now, most of us are insured through our jobs. Still, millions of Americans would be affected if Obamacare failed. Sabrina Corlett is a research professor at Georgetown University.
Many of these folks rely on their insurance to protect them from medical debt and even bankruptcies.
Corlett says for those people, the failure of Obamacare would be devastating. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Here's today's Marketplace Consumer Electronics question. You ever drop your cell phone and crack the screen? Or how many times have you dropped your cell phone and cracked the screen? I guess turns out one in four iPhone owners damage the screen within 2 years of getting the thing. Apple will, of course, fix it for you, as will a whole cottage industry of third-party screen repair technicians. In fact, that's a $4 billion a year business, which Reuters reports today is in for some changes. Marketplace's Ryan Kailoff has the story.
Full disclosure, my iPhone screen is cracked in about 100 different places. I dropped it a few months ago, and I refuse to pay the $129 Apple wants to fix it. Lucky for me, there's this guy.
So we can fix just about anything.
AJ Forsyth is the CEO of iCracked. He started off repairing friends' phones in his dorm room 7 years ago, and now says he has a multi-million dollar company. iCracked can fix just about anything.
With the odd exception of the Touch ID.
That's the technology that lets you unlock the phone with your fingerprint. It's proprietary stuff Apple hasn't shared with third-party vendors.
They created this Horizon machine that we've known about for a long time, but nobody ever confirmed it.
That's Gay Gordon Byrne of the Repair Association, a trade group for technology repairers. The Horizon machine she's referring to is a box that'll do this top-secret Touch ID fix. Apple plans to roll out 400 machines to third-party repair centers by the end of the year. So, outsiders will finally be able to fix everything on the iPhone. That's good news, right?
Well, certainly not my takeaway.
She says Apple should share the tech itself so that anyone can do the repairs, with or without the Horizon machine. Mark Levin of Consumer Intelligence Research Partners says limiting access to that technology is a smart business move for Apple.
Apple relies increasingly on its own customers for sales. So Apple needs to take care of those customers.
And keeping them inside the Apple Store or authorized repair shops keeps them inside the Apple ecosystem. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, more up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a story in the new issue of Forbes magazine that's about money and power and good intentions gone awry. It's a story of a charity and a Trump golf course. The Eric Trump Foundation, set up by the president's second son, raised money for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. It does cancer research. But not all the money went where it appears to have gone. Dan Alexander wrote the piece. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So to sort of unpack this thing for a bit, I guess we start really at the very beginning. Eric Trump, 10 years ago, decides that St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital is going to be his philanthropic focus, right?
That's right.
And decides then to a way to support them is to host golf tournaments.
Yeah. And, you know, at this point, it seems like he's got great intentions. You know, a guy just comes out of college, wants to raise some money. He's got a famous last name and a dad with a lot of rich friends. Says, hey, let's get them all out on the golf course for a day and we can get a lot of money for kids with cancer.
And he does it really efficiently, too. I mean, really low expense ratio because Dad, apparently, the Trump Organization, is donating the course and the services and all of that.
Yeah, it seems that way. Although I will say that the expenses in those early years are about what you would expect from a charity golf tournament in general when you look at what other charities pay for events at Trump courses. And you're right, it's a lot of money and low costs in those early years.
Yeah, and we should say here, just to frame this, I mean, Eric Trump has raised overall for St. Jude's something like $16 million.
That's right. I mean, it's not like he's given away a ton of his own money.
Right.
But regardless, you know, he's raised a lot of money for a great cause.
So to that point then, in 2010, 2011, things start to change. What happens?
You know, in 2011, you see the expenses of the tournament triple. And so we asked around to see, well, how does that happen? If you have a similar event, you know, what's going on? Why are the expenses going up so much? And two people, one of which was a guy who used to work at the club, said basically Donald came in and directly commanded that the foundation begin paying his club.
There is, in this piece, a payment of $100,000 from the Donald J. Trump Foundation, that is the father's philanthropic arm, to the Eric Trump Foundation that then winds up going to the Trump Organization. Explain that.
Yeah, basically it was a business deal. It looks like they just came to an agreement and said, hey, look, we're going to start charging you, but don't worry, it's all good, because in turn I'm going to make a donation from my own foundation. There's one catch here, though, and that's that the money in the Donald Trump Foundation at the time was not his own money. And so what he was doing was he was taking money that other people had donated to his foundation and then giving it to his son's foundation with the understanding that his son would then hold an expensive golf tournament at his club.
This is probably an opportune time to ask you to define self-dealing under the law and philanthropic statutes.
Yes, so self-dealing is something that applies to private foundations, which the Donald J. Trump Foundation is a private foundation. The Eric Trump Foundation, in fact, is a public charity. So it's allowed to do business with companies that people on the board are involved with. However, the private foundation, Donald J. Trump Foundation, is not. And the key thing here is because there was this agreement where the Donald J. Trump Foundation knew that its money would ultimately flow back into its business. You can't have the Donald Trump Foundation doing business with a Donald Trump course, which is what happened.
There is also elsewhere in the piece $500,000 given to other charities from the Eric Trump Foundation, which then those other charities that Eric Trump had, the Eric Trump Foundation had given money to, became clients of the Trump Organization. Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, you see donations coming from the Eric Trump Foundation, and then that year or the next year, you see these charities holding very expensive events of their own at Donald Trump golf courses. It looks like basically altruism as business development.
So acknowledging once again that Eric Trump has done huge amounts of good for St. Jude's.
That's right. What's
the moral of the story?
Well, you know, I think the moral of the story is here's a guy who graduates from college with good intentions. And for a few years, they're doing great things. And then his father gets involved. And then you see a lot of the practices and principles that the charity was founded on sort of start to, you know, dissipate. During the election, right after the election, they said that they were going to suspend the operations of the charity. This is a charity that, in its original form, it's hard to imagine anyone taking issue with it. So they could have been spewing millions of dollars again and again, year after year, to St. Jude Children's Hospital. And instead, you know, you have this tragic situation where they shut it down. St. Jude gets dragged into, you know, negative coverage. And it's just a sad story of good intentions that turned into something much different.
Dan Alexander, he writes for Forbes. Dan, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow's election day over in the UK. Prime Minister Theresa May's gamble on getting a strong popular mandate as she starts Brexit negotiations with the European Union. One of the toughest issues in those talks may well turn out to be immigration. More than 3 million European nationals have exercised their right to settle in Britain under the EU treaty. But since the Brexit vote, EU migration to the UK has slowed sharply, which means that now, of course, there are fears in Great Britain of a labor shortage. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
Anabel, mira.
Isis Acosta, a Spanish citizen, lives with her 2-year-old daughter Annabel and her husband Carlos in London. Until the Brexit vote last year, they had every intention of raising Annabel in Britain.
That's why she was born here, because I felt the public health system was good. We have friends from here. We had a good life until this happened.
And it's not a good life anymore?
The uncertainty for me is terrible.
Uncertainty about her family's rights in post-Brexit Britain. Will they continue to have access to state-funded healthcare and education? Will they even be allowed to stay?
So what will happen with all the people, the European citizens living here? We don't know. The problem is that we don't know.
Have you thought about leaving?
Of course. Every day.
Her husband, Carlos, is torn. He loves his well-paid job in a London software company and revels in its cosmopolitan culture.
They don't care where you're from. You can feel that there is equality of opportunities for everyone.
But he, too, is wondering whether post-Brexit his family would be better off back home. Many would-be migrants are apparently starting to feel the same. Carlos's firm is now finding it much tougher recruiting talent from continental Europe. It's taking much longer to fill vacancies.
Last year was a matter of 2 weeks to 1 month. This year is being a matter of 3 months.
And that's because of Brexit, you think?
Yeah, it's the uncertainty, obviously.
Net immigration into Britain, that's the difference between the numbers coming in and those leaving, has fallen since the Brexit vote, down from about 250,000 a year to about 250,000. That's partly due to EU nationals going home, but also to fewer coming here. Tom Handley is with the REC, a trade body representing recruitment agencies. He says this is fast becoming a crisis.
One of our members who works in the healthcare sector said, look, the number of nurses coming from EU countries is down 80% compared to what it was pre-referendum. So there's definitely a squeeze happening, in particular in areas where we really need staff, like our healthcare service.
In fact, there are shortages across the board, he says, from accountancy to cleaning. And it's a fallacy that there are thousands of British workers lining up to do these jobs.
You still need, you know, to bring workers from outside to fill the number of vacancies that are there, because we're at nearly full employment.
The British government says it's determined that businesses here will get all the labour they need. It wants to guarantee the rights of EU nationals in Britain, but it's demanding a reciprocal deal, which also guarantees the rights of Brits living in the EU. Roger Casale, founder of the New Europeans, a civil rights organisation, is not impressed with the government's position.
What it's really saying is it wants to hold over 3 million EU citizens hostage in the negotiations. Let's remember, we're talking about human beings and their rights, and rights are non-negotiable.
He says the British government should guarantee immediately and unilaterally the right of the European nationals in Britain to stay, and the European Union should do the same for the 1.6 million Brits living in the EU. Common decency demands it, he says, and so does the British economy, say many business leaders here. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, LAX is just this iconic, incredible airport.
True, but also kind of a hot mess right now. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 37 points today, 0.1%, 21,173. The NASDAQ up 22 points, 0.3%, 62.97. The S&P 500 advanced 3 points, about a 0.1%, 24.33. All a bit quiet today as things wait for tomorrow's congressional testimony from former FBI Director James Comey. Also, the results of that election over in the UK. Told you earlier about health insurer Anthem. News gave a boost to its share price, up 0.7%. Meanwhile, Aetna and Humana, as we said, they're going to be exiting their exchanges next year. Also up, Aetna up 1%, Humana up 0.1%. Unexpected data showing the U.S. has way more crude oil in its inventory than previously thought. All that extra supply, what did it do? What did it do? Come on, Economics 101. Price of oil down to $45.77. You're listening to Marketplace. Hi, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Marketplace is here because these days it's essential to have an independent source explaining how the economy really works, not just for CEOs, but for everybody. Your support keeps this kind of reporting coming, and it's especially vital now at the end of our fiscal year. So please visit marketplace.org/donate to contribute and to keep us in your world every day. And thanks.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A moment now for trees. Trees in Southern California specifically, where infestations and drought have put millions of trees at risk. And as the effect of climate change takes hold and hotter and drier weather becomes the norm, cities across the country are investing in programs to monitor their urban forests and also plant trees that can survive well into the future. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
Ever heard of the Pelophagus shot-hole borer beetle? It's tiny, but its impact could be huge. It's infecting millions of trees in California with a fatal fungus. An estimated 27 million could die. If they do, removing and replacing them will be a massive challenge.
It would cost about $36 billion.
Greg McPherson is with the U.S. Forest Service. Beetle kill is the current threat, but in the future, trees will also face hotter, drier, and windier conditions thanks to climate change.
We need to be thinking about transitioning to a more resilient, better adapted urban forest of the future.
That means changing the types of trees we're planting. Liz Skirzot is with City Plants, Los Angeles' tree planting program. She says they're choosing trees that can handle the heat, like the African sumac and Brisbane box, and they're testing out other varieties to see what works.
Trees are what makes cities livable. Trees are what make you want to walk down the street on a hot day. They play a huge role in human health. So it's absolutely critical that we are always investing in trees.
That investment isn't easy. You've got to take a tree-by-tree inventory, come up with a management plan, and monitor the trees while they grow. But Beth Corrigan with Morton Arboretum near Chicago says,
it is less costly to build this program than it would be to lose all of your trees.
Corrigan says many communities in her region did launch replanting programs after beetles killed millions of ash trees throughout the Midwest. But she says most smaller cities and towns don't have the programs or funding they need to prepare urban forests for the future. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
If you've got travel plans this summer that are going to take you through an airport, this next interview might be of interest to you. Deborah Flint is the CEO of Los Angeles World Airports, because, yes, airports have CEOs, too. LAX is the second busiest airport in this country, fourth busiest in the world. It's also in the middle of a multi-billion dollar renovation. So I went out to LAX the other day to chat with Deborah Flint for today's edition of Conversations from the Corner Office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Deborah Flint, good to have you with us.
Thanks for being here at LAX.
Well, it's weird to be out here and not catching a plane, as I was just saying before we turn the microphones on. How much time actually do you spend at LAX as a customer, as an actual passenger?
Far less time than that I'm here, yeah. No doubt. But I do get to have my own unique passenger experiences.
So what do you think of the passenger experience at LAX as a passenger?
I love the opportunities to be out in the terminals. Yeah. It's the part of the airports that I actually love the most, rather than being here in the conference rooms. But this is where the magic happens for the passenger. And, you know, LAX is just this iconic, incredible airport. You see, you know, over 200,000 passengers a day come through here.
When they called you and said, hey, listen, we've got this job, but there are some downsides. It's old, it's crowded, we're in the middle of a gazillion dollar renovation program, it's going to be a heavy lift. What was your reaction?
Serendipity. I had been always watching LAX. And the city of Los Angeles is so fresh, it's so cool, it's so vibrant, it's the entertainment capital. LAX, to me, is the brand that should set the stage for national aviation as well as global aviation. But because of my industry background, it also was clear to me for a long time that LAX needed to be in this transformative era.
So I'm a United guy. Spent a lot of time in Terminal 7, and they're rehabbing that, and it's great, and it's nice. You all just did the big Delta move from Terminal 5 to 2.
They switched from the
major
north
airline
to the south.
How much time do you spend on the phone with, say, Ed Bastian at Delta or Oscar Munoz at United?
They are very involved when it comes to making the deals here at the airport. LAX is unique in that many of the large hub airports across the country may have one single dominant air carrier. Mm-hmm. At LAX, we have not one airline that has more than 20% market share.
Wow.
That's great for the passengers. The fares are competitive as a result of competition. And that's the model that should be in place for airports around the country. One of the reasons why airports are seeking to find new funding mechanisms that's not necessarily held by just one airline.
So play that out a little bit, right? You're part of the city of Los Angeles government structure. You get fees from airlines. Where else do you get revenue, and how can you grow your revenue to do this big renovation that you're in the middle of for the next 6-8 years?
A happy passenger is a spending passenger. And that's incredibly important to us, because the federal government says to airports, we want you to be self-sustaining, right? Meaning whatever money you generate, you need to keep to the airport so that you can support your operations and your capital development program. And so a key to that is what we call our passenger facility charge. And as an industry, we've been working really hard to try and get that modernized and increased.
What are you saying when you say modernized and increased? Is that the passengers are going to be paying more?
Paying more and increase it to what it originally was authorized at. But paying more in one regard goes directly back to your own local airport in better passenger experience, less lines, chargers, for instance, for you to have when you're waiting for your flights. I mean, these are your local government spending that fee for the betterment of your experience.
Who's your competition, I guess, right? Because it's not like I've got a whole lot of choices if I have to fly from Los Angeles to somewhere. I mean, I could go to, I could go to John Wayne down in Orange County. I could go to Ontario, I suppose. But
you could. And those are real choices. Airports are very competitive. International flights in particular are so attractive to the local economy. Over $70 million is generated from one international flight in terms of jobs and spending. I appreciate the 50,000 plus jobs that are right here at LAX. Hmm. And we still have more people that we want to see get good jobs and work here because of the airports.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
This being Wednesday, we've got the full interview of my conversation with Deborah Flint out on the Corner Office podcast. You can find Ed Bastian there, too, the CEO of Delta. Get him wherever you like to get your podcasts. Final note on the way out today, energy policy, infrastructure, and immigration all rolled into one. President Trump said again yesterday, you might have heard this, that he is going to build that wall and that better yet, maybe there would be solar panels on it. So we made some calls.
When you look at the wall, there are a lot of people that have been talking about 50 feet to 65 feet.
Jigar Shah is the president of Generate Capital.
It looks like you could mount about 10 solar panels on the wall. But you'd probably want to limit that to 5, so you'd have less shading and you'd have more optimal solar panel production. So that gets me to something on the order of 5,000 megawatts across 2,000 miles of wall, which would produce about 6.6 billion kilowatt hours a year.
And then?
And so at about 6 cents a kilowatt hour, which is the average price of the power in Mexico, the electricity would be worth about $400 million a year. And over the 40-year life of a solar panel, that means that you could collect about $16 billion, not counting the tax credits that are already in place for solar and the low-cost debt you could get from the North American Development Bank.
And even better.
Yeah, there's already treaties in place that allow Mexico to buy power from us. And so it's actually not that hard to sell power to Mexico.
Which means...
it would technically allow him to say that Mexico paid for the wall.
I know, right? Assuming, of course, it gets built. Holy cow, look at the time we got to go. The Dow up 37 today, about a 10th percent. NASDAQ up 22, 3/10 percent. S&P 500 up 3 points, about a 10th percent. Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.